Okay, let's turn in our Bible then to 1 Kings chapter 3. I've entitled this, Have You Prayed? James 1:5. 1:5, If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives men all men liberally and abradeth not, and it shall be given to him. Wisdom is an attribute of God. Colossians 2:3, In Jesus are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. And 1 Corinthians 1:30, by God's doing we're in Christ Jesus, who of God has made unto us wisdom, righteousness, sanctification, redemption, which is the means of our salvation. Proverbs 2:6, for the Lord gives wisdom, from his lips comes knowledge and understanding. Wisdom, discernment, and spiritual maturity are all interconnected. They are all interconnected. A great little book to read, I don't know how many of you read it, but it's Fool's Gold by John MacArthur. Brent, you read it? Pastor Ryan? Yeah. It's a great little book. It was found in one of the Shepherd's Conferences in California there at MacArthur's church. But the subtitle there, The Call for Discernment in a Non-Discerning Age. And that is our age for sure. The cognitive ability to understand, interpret, and apply doctrinal truth skillfully. And that is our word this year for the fellowship at Grace Baptist is discernment. And that is interconnected with wisdom and spiritual maturity. There is no spiritual maturity. There is no wisdom without the discernment. And the same thing for the others there. It's tightly connected together. And we see that here with Solomon as he exercises wisdom, the importance of wisdom in dealing with the issues of life. This court case is proof of 3:12. So look at 3:12 here before we read our text. This is the proof of 3:12. 1 Kings chapters 3 through 11 has to do with King Solomon. 3:12, Behold, God says, I've done according to your word. See, I've given you a wise and understanding heart. That understanding heart, remember, is a listening heart, a hearing heart, so that there has not been anyone like you before you, nor shall any like you arise after you. So, and godly wisdom can find a simple solution to a difficult dilemma. The outline here will give an introduction, and then the difficult dilemma, verses 16 through 22, the discerning decision, verses 23 to 28, and then in conclusion, the discerning deity. So let's read our text tonight, reading from God's Word, 1 Kings 3, 16 through 28. Now two women, who were harlots, came to the king and stood before him. One woman said, O my Lord, this woman and I dwell in the same house, and I gave birth while she was in the house. Then it happened the third day after I had given birth that this woman also gave birth, and we were together. No one was with us in the house except the two of us in the house. And this woman's son died in the night because she lay on him. So she arose in the middle of the night, took my son from my side while your maidservant slept, laid him in her bosom, and laid her dead child in my bosom. And when I rose in the morning to nurse my son, there he was dead. But when I examined him in the morning, indeed, he was not my son whom I had borne. Then the other mother said, No, but the living one is my son, and the dead one is your son. And the first woman said, No, but the dead one is your son, and the living one is my son. Thus they spoke before the king. And the king said, The one says, This is my son who lives, and your son is the dead one. And the other says, No, but your son is the dead one, and my son is the living one. Then the king said, Bring me a sword. So they brought a sword before the king. And the king said, Divide the living child in two, and give half to one and a half to the other. Then the woman whose son was living spoke to the king, for she yearned with compassion for her son. And she said, O my Lord, give her the living child, and by no means kill him. But the other said, Let him be neither mine nor yours, but divide him. So the king answered and said, Give the first woman the living child, and by no means kill him. She is his mother. And all Israel heard of the judgment which the king had rendered, and they feared the king, for they saw that the wisdom of God was in him to administer justice. May God commit the reading of his word to our minds, hearts, and wills tonight for his glory, our eternal good, by his Spirit. There's always something deeply satisfying about finding a simple solution to a difficult dilemma. Nancy and I could have used that this week. We had to buy a new computer. Oh, did we have fun. Let's just say there was several wasted hours during the week so far. If we were more computer literate, it would have been shortened up quite immensely, but that's the way it goes. A more famous example of dilemma solving comes from the ancient place of the Phrygian kings in Gordium. You've heard of the Gordian knot. There was an ox cart tied to a post with an intricate knot. According to legend, whoever was able to untie the knot would rule Asia Minor. Never a man to back down from a challenge and having some considerable interest in ruling Asia Minor himself, Alexander the Great tried to untie the knot when he wintered at Gordium in 333 BC. Upon discovering that the knot did not have any ends to unravel, Alexander undid the Gordian knot by taking his sword, slicing it in two. A simple solution to a seemingly difficult, insolvable dilemma. 1 Kings 3:16 through 18 offers another historical illustration of a simple solution to a insolvable dilemma. A court case brought before Solomon in the form of a legal dispute over the custody of a child. Now, we can assume, and I think this is very interesting, that this case had been already heard in inferior courts before it was ever brought before Solomon. Think back on Moses. Remember when Moses was trying to try everything and then Jethro, his father-in-law, told him in Exodus 17, 18, there to have other judges under him that would try the lesser cases, and then he'd only take the more difficult ones, see, and that he wouldn't waste all his time on all of these, and it saved the people a lot of time. So the difficult case, you see, it finally ends up in Solomon's lap because everybody else had tried it. Just think that he probably had some levels there, and nobody else had solved it, so the king gets it in his lap. And this is all, of course, God's doing. And it had been found to be a special case because nobody had been able to determine it. If Solomon in his wisdom solved the case, you can imagine what would happen. He would be exponentially sought after, and his fame would speed like wildfire. And God said that he would give him honor, riches, and honor or fame. And we see at the end here, that's exactly what happened. All Israel heard it, and you can imagine what happened. It's not just Israel that fame spread beyond to other nations besides. I've been reading the biography again of Martin Lloyd Jones, and I enjoy it so much. It's only the fourth time that I've been reading it. And as a medical doctor and as a physician of souls, the preachers in the area, they didn't want to have anything to do with the doctor. And the doctors in the area didn't want to have anything to do with him as a doctor or a preacher because they thought he was, you know, neither really, you know, one or the other because he split his time, as it were. So the doctors badmouthed him and the preachers in the area badmouthed him. Well, as the Lord would have it, the leader of the opposition in that, his brother, ended up to be very sick. And Bethan came home one day and told Martin that God had told her that there'd be a knock on the door and it would be those men asking for his advice. And Martin said, "No way, this just can't be." Well, a couple days later, there was a knock at the door. And there was this guy asking. if Martin Lloyd-Jones would come and give his advice. So he got in the car. He didn't own a car. He got in the car. He rode with him, and on the way there, asked, well, what's the history of the patient? So they gave him the history of the patient. Martin Lloyd-Jones made the diagnosis before he ever got to the house. As it turns out, he had a research fellowship studying Hodgkin's lymphoma, and he was studying a special kind of Hodgkin's lymphoma that was exactly the symptoms that this man had. And Martin Lloyd-Jones was very familiar with it, though it was very rare, but he had researched it. He made the diagnosis while in the car, and of course all that did was ratchet up, no way, you don't know what you're talking about. So he said, I'll go in and I'll look at the man, and he looked at the man and he confirmed it exactly, told him what would happen. The man could live for a time, but he would die, and that's exactly what happened. Afterwards, it was very interesting. The response was, that man, who was the leading physician in the whole area, would not take anybody's advice outside of London on any medical case at all, unless it was Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones. So what happened was, Martin Lloyd-Jones had all these people from other churches that were asking him for medical advice. Those in the church, he did not charge a fee. Those outside of the church that sought medical advice, because it was taking his time that, he did ask a fee. And that fee was used then, went into the Sandfields Fund that paid off the debt on the church building. God works in mysterious ways. Let's read chapter 3, verses 7 through 13, just for context here, because like we said, this is a proof. Now, this court case is proof of 312. For background, verses 7 through 12, chapter 3. Now, O Lord, my God, Solomon in his prayer to God here, you have made your servant king instead of my father David, but I'm a little child. I don't know how to go in or come out. There's a Hebrew merism. A young man, just starting in kingship, sure he'd grown up in the court, the royal court, but remember, David wasn't much of a father. He was a warring king. He's always off to war and all this stuff. Who knows how much he actually taught his sons in terms of how to rule and to reign. It's kind of like my dad, remember? I told you when he was he ran the farm at age 14, and when he got into the service at age 17, by the time he was 18, he had 32 men working under him on these boats that unloaded the soldiers at D-Day and all that. And when we farmed, he fixed the combines himself. He did all of that stuff and never took the time to teach my brother and I anything. And we knew where every tool was on his shop because he'd go in, hurry up, fix something, and on his way running out, he says, you boys clean up! So we knew where every tool was on the board. And that's all we knew. That's all we knew. So that probably was the case with Solomon also. So he prays, therefore give to your servant an understanding, a listening, a hearing heart to judge your people, that I may discern between good and evil. The simplest definition of discernment, remember, is Hebrews 5:14, just this. You are to judge between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours? This is foremost on Solomon's mind now. The speech pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing. Then God said to him, because you've asked this thing and have not asked long life for yourself, nor have asked riches for yourself, nor asked the life of your enemies, and have asked for yourself understanding to discern justice. There's an echo then of what Solomon desired there at the end of verse 9. Behold, I have done according to your words. See, I have given you a wise and understanding heart. So there's not been anyone like you before you, nor shall anyone like you arise after you. That is, of any human being. Jesus, of course, the God-man, in him are all hidden all the riches of wisdom and knowledge. They're infinite. And as it says in Matthew 12:42, a greater than Solomon was here, and that was Jesus Christ. And I have also given you what you've asked, not for asked for, then riches and honor or fame, so not be anyone like you among the kings all your days. So when we look at wisdom, in the Old Testament it is called chokmah. Chokmah in the Hebrew, and the wisdom literature. Law told me he took a course at Reformed Bible College on wisdom literature. So somebody tell me, what is the wisdom literature in the Bible? We've gone through this. What's the wisdom literature in the Bible? First book? Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon. Okay, that's the wisdom literature in the Bible. The wisdom literature in the Bible covers all of human experience, includes understanding, insight, intelligence. But what it really boils down to, it is rightly using the knowledge, biblical knowledge, spiritual knowledge especially, but rightly using all knowledge, then skillfully to work righteousness before God and also to what's right before your fellow man. It'll bring success and prosperity. True wisdom is a gift of God. It's an attribute of God, as we said, Colossians 2:3, 1 Corinthians 1:3. Proverbs 9:10, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Psalm 111:10 says the same thing. Fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. When we think of God, what does the Westminster Shorter Catechism question number 4 say? Anybody remember that? Question is, what is God? And the answer is what? God is a spirit, infinite, eternal, and his being, wisdom, power, holiness, justice, goodness, truth. First attribute listed there, wisdom, wisdom, wisdom. Job, the theme verse. Theme verse of Job is 28:28. He said to man, "Fear the Lord is the beginning. Fear the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is understanding." I think that's what it is, or did I quote from the Psalm? Let me. A senior moment. Job 28, theme verse in Job. Fear the Lord, yeah, that is wisdom. Depart from evil is understanding. The fear of the Lord, that is wisdom. Depart from evil is understanding. Proverbs 1:7, knowledge of God is understanding, and fools despise wisdom. Fools despise wisdom and understanding. Fools despise wisdom and understanding. So you not only have this prudence or wisdom then in secular affairs or religious affairs, but it's secular affairs also. I've quoted it before, but John MacArthur, true wisdom is properly and effectively applying God's truths to everyday life. That is the skill in living righteously. And what is righteousness? This is my abbreviation for righteousness. Righteousness is conformity to God. So you're walking then in the footsteps of God, in the path of God, walking in the steps of Jesus. Footprints of Jesus that make the pathway glow, as we sing. Okay? But it's skill. See, it's a skill. J.I. Packer. Wisdom in Scripture always means knowledge of the course of action that will please God and secure life. And when we're talking about securing life, remember that's everlasting life, but that's also life then as God has it. Godliness in living. Proverbs 3:19, the Lord by wisdom founded the earth, by understanding the heavens. Proverbs 3:19, the Lord by wisdom founded the earth by understanding the heavens. So James 1:5, you and I are to ask for wisdom. Proverbs 2:6, for the Lord gives wisdom, from his lips comes knowledge and understanding. From his lips come knowledge and understanding. Proverbs 4:7, wisdom is the principal thing, therefore get wisdom. Very important. And Proverbs 8:35, you've got Proverbs 9:1 through 6 is the personification of wisdom. Proverbs 8:35, wisdom says there, whoever finds wisdom finds me, finds life. Yeah. The law of God reveals the character of God, who God is through the law. Yeah. And in that, then, we need the wisdom, the skill in living righteously, then, conformity to God. In fact, let me see, Psalm 85:13. Yeah. Righteousness will go before him, God, and shall make his footsteps our pathway. Okay, now let's look at point number one here, the difficult dilemma. Start in verse 16. Let me get back here. I'm off here in Psalms. 1 Kings 16. Now two women who were harlots came to the king, stood before him. No lawyers involved in this case or other legal representatives, just one woman against another. You got two harlots, two whores, two prostitutes. In the Hebrew, it's zana. Zana. What is interesting to me, this could also refer to innkeepers. Innkeepers. Turn in your Bible to Joshua 2:1. Now think in terms of Jesus' day. He's got his Joseph's got his pregnant wife going to bear Jesus, and they come to this inn, and you imagine what those inns were like. But look at Joshua 2:1. Now Joshua the son of Nun sent out two men from Acacia Grove to spy secretly, saying, go view the land, especially Jericho. So they went and came to the house of a harlot named Rahab and lodged there. Yes. Yes. And just think, so he would have two harlots before the king, Solomon, in the king's court.
Astonishing for human rights.
Yes. Astonishing for human rights is right. Yes. Now, what is interesting, in the ancient Near Eastern kings, they kept records of exceptional legal decisions which were presented to their deity as a report that they had acted wisely as a just king. Okay? So this follows, you see, this same practice. Turn in your Bible there, the words of King Lemuel's mother, Proverbs 31, to her son. Proverbs 31, verses 1 through 9. The words of King Lemuel, the utterance which his mother taught him. What, my son, and what, son of my womb, and what, son of my bowels? Do not give your strength to women, nor your ways to that which destroys kings. It's not for kings, O Lemuel. It's not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes intoxicating drink, lest they drink and forget the law, and pervert the justice of all the afflicted. Give strong drink to him who is perishing, and wine to those who are bitter of heart. Let him drink and forget his poverty, and remember misery no more. Open your mouth for the speechless. In the cause of all who are appointed to die, open your mouth, judge righteously, and plead the cause of the poor, the needy, and the harlots. We could add, see, the poor, the needy, and the harlots. But how important, you see, that is. And think of Deuteronomy, the words to kings in Deuteronomy 17, 14 through 20. When you look at verse 20, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brethren, that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right or to the left. Now, does everybody remember in the Old Testament what that means? When it says, like in Proverbs 4:27, do not turn to the right or to the left. What? Straight, what does that mean? Straight. To be straight then is what? It's an idiom for righteousness. Right. So when you see that in the Old Testament, that's a Hebrew idiom for righteousness. The illustration I always use is when Chuck Swindoll was in the Navy in World War II. And they were at port in the Philippines. And the ship would dock, and there was a red light district, the whores and the prostitutes, and then their base was on the other side where they lodged. So you had to go through the red light district to get to your bed for the night, see, and to get to the cafeteria and all that stuff on base. So a lot of the guys got detoured, and Chuck Swindoll said he made it his practice. He got off the ship, and the first thing he did, he didn't look to the left, he didn't look to the right. He put it in high gear, he ran straight down the middle of the road until he got to base. Never looked to the left or the right. In other words, he what? He lived righteously. See, that's an idiom for righteousness. Okay, verse 17. And one woman said, O my Lord, this woman and I dwell in the same house, and I gave birth while she was in the house. This woman is the plaintiff. Okay? The plaintiff. And this is in verses then 17 through 21. Verses 17 through 21. She gives her testimony. So what it does is it takes us to a whorehouse in a red light district in Jerusalem. Yeah. Yeah. And then the defendant will respond here in verse 22. Her testimony takes us to a whorehouse in a red light district in Jerusalem. Now, there's no clients that particular night of the birth. Now, I don't think anybody is too close to the whore when she's about ready to give birth. Okay, that's just facts of life. There are no clients around then. And nobody is particularly caring for them, or there's no midwives present, there's no anybody present. No witnesses to the circumstances, so we end up with what? She said, she said. That's what a case we're looking at. So verses 17 to 21, the one woman, she said, and then in verse 22, the other, she said. That's what we're dealing with. Verse 18. Then it happened. Now, if there's anything you know, if you've been at Grace Baptist any time, Pastor Ron does not like that at all. I don't know why they ever translate that way. Because that indicates what? Chance? Paganism? Idolatry? Get out your rabbit's foot, roll your dice, look for your four-leaf clover, whatever. It came to pass. There's nothing in life that is outside of God's jurisdiction. It came to pass. The predetermined counsel of God is now actualized. It doesn't just happen by chance. Okay? Okay. Now, I know that, and all things are like. Did you know that these stupid glasses of mine, now the older I get, you know, I put in lots of exercise. I get my steps in every day because I put these stupid things down and I can't remember where I put them, so I get to my study and I'm going to study. No glasses. So then I have to walk to the other end of the house to pick the glasses up and then walk back. See, so I get all these extra steps every day. So I go after the service on Sunday and I have the other glasses without the strap that I wear during the service, and I put them in the glass case and I walk out and I go home. Where are my stupid glasses? I can't find them. Looking all over. I come back for the Sunday night service and there they are, sitting right by the case. First time I've ever done that. And so what Nancy and I say to each other after those kind of episodes now, we just say stay tuned, because there's going to be more of those things happening all the time. So yeah, I'm making all these extra steps, see, for these glasses. No one is in the house with us. No stranger. Oh, I was going to say, yeah, well, here, God, finish my thought. Okay. So what happened was I forgot something at church. What was, oh, yeah, for, what did I, yeah. Oh, yeah, Amy's bag. We had Amy out at church. We're walking her. I put it on the wheelchair, wheeled her out, got her in the car, wheeled it back with the bag on there, put that in the room there. Got home, and Amy says, where's my bag? Nancy's looking all over for bag, can't find it. Well, then the light bulb goes on and says, I know where it is. So I got in the car, make my extra steps again, come out and find the bag. Well, when I come out here, there's two Corinne out here taking apples off the apple tree. Oh. I said, who are you? And they said to me, who are you? Oh, I'm the pastor here. Oh, what are you doing up in our church family's apple tree taking the apples? I've never seen you two before. Well, blah, 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 blah. Flo 2 told us. No, I found out, Nancy and I made calls. Flo 2 didn't tell them. But I know Flo 2 is going to find out who they are. So I let them have some apples. Grace took over instead of over my madness. See? They had no right to take church apples at all. But you see, did that just happen? Did that just happen? No. That was predetermined by God that I forgot Amy's bag so that I came out here at just the right time to catch those two idiots in the tree. They had a ladder and they just started after we left. And of course, they know from the look on my face, if I ever see them again, they're going to be in real trouble, because that's why we have a no trespassing sign out here. See, we can take somebody to court if we so desire. If the law takes over for grace. But anyway, remember that. When you ever see that, just cross it off, put it came to pass. The predetermined counsel of God is now actualized. Okay. Nothing outside of God's purvey. See, it's all predetermined by God. Known to God are all his works over everything from eternity. So no one was in the house with us. Literally, it means no strangers. There's no clients. They were so poor, there's no servants, there's no nurses. So slighted as harlots, no friend with them in their time of need to accompany or help them or whatever. Okay? A sad situation. Verse 19. The woman's son died in the night because she lay on him. Now, I had one commentator said, she carelessly rolled over on her child. Now, did you know what the average person, how many times the average person rolls over in their sleep at night? Give me a guess. Okay, this is the studies. I can clue you in right now. I'm way over this. Nancy's under it. So we average out. That's the average. That's it. Yeah. I'm sure you know that. I'm sure you know that when you're sleeping. Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. It's like the husband saying to the wife, you know, you snore at night. And the wife says, no, I don't. And you can prove it nowadays. You know, all you do is got to get out, you know, the little thing and record it. But you see, that's the same kind of thing, you know. I don't roll over at night, you know. You know what? I know how to stop Nancy snoring at night. See, I Brent, little okay, heads up here. What I do is I just kick her. I kick her. She's sleeping, she hasn't got a clue. She doesn't know. If I didn't tell her that I kicked her in the middle of the night and she stopped snoring, she wouldn't know. See? But when the snoring wakes me up, I just kick her in the shins and that stops it. See? So, you know, when somebody says I don't roll over, I don't snore, now you just take it with a grain of salt and say, oh yeah, sure. Yeah. Okay. Verse 19, tragic occurrence. And I've often, so I would put, instead of carelessly, I would put what? A word like inadvertently. 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 And I've often wondered on Koreans. I have yet to hear of a Korean where the mother, because the Koreans have their children sleeping with them all, you know, all the time. In fact, a sad case was I heard of one Korean mother, get a load of this. I'm not going to name names. But they had their 30-some-year-old son sleeping between mom and dad at night in the same bed. Okay, we won't go any farther with that. But I've often wondered, I've never heard of a case of a Korean mother suffocating their child. But we think of, in America, we've heard a lot about infant crib death and all of that. And I can remember as a young father, that thought would kind of, you know, back of my mind, I was aware of that, you know. And that to me is just tragic, you know. And the infant can be in the crib and suffocate there, you know, during the night. And just sad, really sad. Verse 20. So she arose in the middle of the night, and she took my son from my side while your maidservant slept, and laid her in her bosom, and laid her dead child in my bosom. Now, the mother that this happened to, she's sleeping. She's recording something that she determined happened, because there were only the two of them in the thing. So how did the dead child get by my side in the morning? Well, somebody might have pushed it there. Well, let me see. Who else is in the house here? There's only one other person in the house. So it's not too hard to deduce that what the lady is saying is the true story, even though she was sleeping when it happened. See? So we don't say, no, you're making it up. No. Now, what does she say at verse 20? And laid her dead child in my bosom. There's one thing I can affirm to you on this, on fact, is a mother knows her own child. A mother knows her own child. You don't slip somebody else's child in a mother's arm and says, this is your child. The mother knows. Now, lawyers today, in our case net, we'd probably call this a case of accidental death. Accidental death. And I don't like the term accident at all, because it's there again. In God's sovereignty, there are no accidents. He's over all things. Mother suffocated her own child. And you say, how does a mother deal with that? How does a parent deal with that? I once heard a case, true case. Father got in his car in his driveway, backed his car out of the driveway, and ran over his infant child, his son. Now, I often ask myself, how was I as a father, how would I ever live with that? How could you live with that? Now, this lady, this was envy. This was envy. My child is now dead. She has a living child. You know what? I don't want her to have her child either. So I'm going to take the child. It's a case of envy, hate involved here, emotions. It would drive, you see, the haunting thought here is, I killed my child. And the haunting thought is, it can drive people to all sorts of extremes, to commit every evil under the sun, even switching babies during the night. See, while the other mother slept. Now, this is a true case. My brother's best friend was a fellow doctor, worked in an emergency room, emergency doc, and he was going out for an evening for dinner with his wife, and they left their younger children, and one of them was an infant son, toddler, should say, with a 15-year-old younger brother of the wife. And the father knew about this 15-year-old brother, and you can imagine, didn't have the greatest, you know, thought of him. But anyway, what happened is that the toddler wandered into the swimming pool and drowned. And the 15-year-old wasn't watching the toddler. And when the 15-year-old finally went out wondering what happened to the toddler, of course he is in the pool, dead. Then the 15-year-old panicked, and he did not call 911 immediately. In fact, he didn't call at all. And so what happened is, when the mother came home, the toddler had been dead for 3 to 4 hours. 3 to 4 hours. And so what they did was, they took the child to the nearest hospital, to the ER room, and the doctor on call was dead. And you bring in his dead son. The bad thing through all of this is he tried hard, of course, to revive the child, his own son. But infants have a great capacity to revive even after stopping breath for over an hour. If that child would have been brought in 3/4 of an hour after it happened, an hour, hour and a quarter, that child probably could have been revived. But that 15-year-old panicked and didn't do anything for 3 to 4 hours. That dad couldn't come to grips with that death. Blamed the wife, and it ended up in divorce. How do you come to grips with a situation when one of your children are killed in circumstances like that? I had a panic situation in my own life. Nance remembers this. Is it as a young dad? There was snow on the roof. First house we had over on Bonham Boulevard in Wilmer. So I climbed up onto the roof to check for the snow, and like an idiot, I brought my oldest son with me, a toddler. And I set him on the peak of the roof. I proceeded to investigate the snow, and I slipped, and I headed over the edge. And as I was going over the edge, headed for the sidewalk head first, I yelled, "Bob, don't move," to the top of my lungs. And when I headed for the sidewalk head first, I spread-eagled, and as the Lord would have it, I caught the railing with my arm and my leg. And because of that, that kind of broke the fall. So when I hit the steps, my head was at the bottom of the step, my feet were at the top. And my first reaction was to see if anything was moving, could move. And I thank the Lord, other than being bruised, I came out of that with no physical injury. And as the Lord would have it, Bob stayed put on the peak of the roof. And I often thought, what would have happened if Dad would have gotten injured and the son went to investigate where Dad was and went over the roof, edge of the roof? What would have happened? Let's just say God is good. The other thing I learned as a parent, you think of these babies here, You know, growing up, I assumed that birth was just something, you know, there's a baby there, you know, everything's fine, no problems, you know, until I was going to be a parent and it was my child. Cool. Take notes. Then the whole thing changed. And then you put me in the medical field besides, I had every scenario in my mind of all sorts of things that could go wrong. Things that could go wrong. And then I think of Psalm 139:14. The child is fearfully and wonderfully made by God. Just think of all the things that could go wrong. And these harlots, you say, oh, these are just harlots. But think of the natural affection for the child. They kept the child. They didn't abort the child. Didn't want to get rid of the child. They wanted to keep their child. We're living in perilous times now. 2 Timothy 3:1-3. Got abortion, abortion pills, adoption, kids, abandonment. Right now, you know, in our society, the marriage rate is plummeting. They don't even want to get married. And the last thing you want is some kid to interfere with your freedom and your lifestyle. Unwanted and unloved, a lot of children. In fact, now I just, listening to the news today in New Jersey now, they've got laws now where they're going to punish the parents for these juveniles because the juveniles aren't supervised. And the juveniles are going out after dark committing all these crimes. You name it, they commit it. And they're repeat cases, repeat, repeat. So finally now the whole neighborhood, this city and everything, everybody agreed. Now they're going to penalize the parents of these kids because they're not parenting. See, they could care less. They're into their own thing. Verse 22, here's the defendant's response. The defendant's response. Verse 22. Then the other woman said, no. Now, I've told you this before, you know, it's too bad we don't have audio, because when the Hebrews read their Bible, they always read it out loud. Have you ever tried that? Sometime you read a passage like this, just read it to yourself, and then compare when you read it out loud. I will tell you, it'll give much more meaning to you if you read it out loud. And then when you read it out loud, try to imagine, you see, what this response would be now. I think what you've got for a response here is, you've got, I circled here on verse 22, the other woman said, no, but the living one is my son, and the dead one is your son. And then the first woman said, no, but the dead one is your son, and the living one is my son. Thus they spoke before the king. Now, do you think that was all it amounted to, or do you think this amounted to a shouting match where things got ratcheted up and it got heated, where these two women were probably going at each other's throat? And the king is observing all of this, and it's probably only because of the king intervening that you didn't probably come to blows or anything here, but you can imagine the intensity of emotion here with the no, see, and then the other woman responding with, no! See? Probably even a louder. See? Again, no witnesses, you see. What do you do? She said, she said. That's all you've got here. The accused wanted her chance to speak, to mount a defense, a rebuttal, to dispute the first woman's account of the events. At this point, you see, I contend that, yes, it degenerates into a shouting match. Imagine the emotion again. This word no. Circle it. Circle it in that verse. Each claiming the live son is their own. There's no DNA testing. See? No DNA testing. You can't determine anything here. And did it go on back and forth? Was there many more no's? You see, how long did Solomon observe this before he silenced them? See? Now we get to verse 23, which is the king's summary. The king's summary. He's going to take now what he has heard and he's going to repeat it. He's a good listener. Did you know that Nancy and I took a seminary course together? It was on listening. It was a popular course in seminary. One, because you got a credit for a course that was easy, okay? But you got to take it with your wife. So when I'm driving to the cities, I didn't have to drive by myself. I drove with my wife. So we got down there and we take this course on listening. And what they did was listening is they put a circle on the floor. Remember that, Nancy? Put a circle on the floor. Sort of. Okay. Anyway, I'm the SEM student. She wasn't. Okay. But anyway. So then, you know, you stand in the circle. See? And you've got this interchange between your wife and you, and you have the interchange. The first thing you do, you know, how many times when you get into something, you know, when you had a disagreement on something or other, you know, you're already thinking about what you're going to say. See, you already got my response. Okay. No. So what you do is, the first thing you do in this course, see, I'm listening. Did you listen to what this person was saying? So the first thing is just like Solomon here. What does he do? He repeats exactly what he heard, see, just to say, now, oh, have I got this right now? Did I really listen? Have I really heard what you're saying? See? So that's what we had to do. And that was repeated throughout the course. First thing. So this one of the principles and first practices of being a good listener is to say, okay, is this what you're saying? Do I hear you saying? And you actually repeat then what the other person is saying to you. See? So there's no chance, see, that you miss something. So this is what Solomon does here. King says, the king said, so the one says, this is my son who lives, and your son is a dead one. Now you, the other lady here, you're saying no, but your son is a dead one, and my son is a living one. Okay. So now we get to verses 24 and 25. King heard right. Now we get the king's verdict. The king's verdict here. We're getting here now into this discerning decision. See, the discerning decision. So the two women here give an identical story. Can you imagine if you and I were in the courtroom? Just think now, this case has come up from all these, let's say, other lesser courts, and you know, nobody has any solution to this at all. See? So now every... Well, that's right. That's right. It's not there. Let's see. There's a case here about an... what was it here? Let's see if I remember here. Let's see. Maybe I've got it. But there's one case, but it has to do with an ox or something else, some animal. There's never a human case at all. See, so I mean, that's as close as you get some case. Anyway. Can you imagine the anticipation in the courtroom? I mean, you could have heard a pin drop. I mean, kind of, you know, waiting here what the king is going to say. You're kind of bated breath as to what's going to come out. Is he going to come out with a foolish statement here or something? Or is there going to be wisdom here? What's going to come out of here, see? And this is a seemingly impossible dilemma. And is there a solution? Is the king going to have a solution? So you imagine here, let's imagine a little bit. Would Solomon assign visiting rights to each of the mothers? Well, there's one child, there's two mothers here. So you take the child for this part of the week, and then you take the child for this part of the week, and then you can both have a child then, see? Or would he call for lot? Let's cast a lot, see? You want the short straw or the long straw, see? Who knows? We probably could come up with, you know, other things. Do we have sympathy for Solomon? I mean, how would you like to be the king in this predicament here? Everybody looking at you to come up with the answer here, see? Ordinarily, you look at Deuteronomy 19:15, what would be the, we'd hope for the solution? You'd want two or three witnesses. So now would be the time. We'll call for witness number, you know, whatever here. Come up and tell this, and add some more evidence, and on the basis of two or three, you can confirm the truth. Well, you don't have that here, see? No other witnesses again. Two women, alone in the night, she said, she said. Parents often deal with dilemmas like this. I told you before when I was growing up, you know, my folks would line us three kids up. Who did it? Well, stand there, you know, no answer. I don't know. You know. So they get three I don't knows or whatever out of the three kids. And all I remember is that the oldest one was the most looked on as responsible. So he's the one that got the belt. And you know who that was. The first one to proclaim the case seems right until his neighbor comes and what? Cross-examines him. Proverbs 18:17. Proverbs 18:17. First one to plead his case seems right until his neighbor comes and cross-examines him. You got a dispute between two employees at work. You got a fight at school between two teenagers. You got pastors trying to resolve family conflict. To design that, R.C. Sproul, I remember once he was talking about counseling, and he said, really, a lot of people come into counsel with pastors. They vie between themselves if they can get the pastor to agree with them. It gets to be a contest. But we know there's one person who always knows the truth. One person always knows the truth. There's only one person who knows the heart. 1 Kings 8:39, that's God. In Hebrews 8:13, neither is there anything that is not manifest in His sight. 4:13, all things are naked and open unto the eyes of Him with whom we have to do. 1 Kings 8:39, God alone knows the heart. And Psalm 139, I think it's 12, you know, the darkness is as the light to the Lord. Everything is light to Him. You can't, somebody will say, well, character is what you do in the dark. No, God sees it all. Whether it's light or dark, it's all the same to Him. He sees it all. Verses 24 and 25, then the king said, bring me a sword. Can you imagine the shock on people? What? He's going to kill the child. That you call this wisdom? What a fool! This is ridiculous. They brought a sword before the king. The king said, divide the living child in two and give half to one, half to the other. No wonder it says in Proverbs 25:3, it says that the hearts of kings are unsearchable. Hearts of kings are unsearchable. Here it is. It's Exodus 21:35. Exodus 21:35, when you get to the law of Moses, Exodus 31:25, there was a law concerning the dividing of a living ox from a dead one. But you see, that didn't reach the level of this case at all. Some feel Solomon had discerned the true mother already, but by this approach, hid, gives satisfaction to everyone. His approach here, he'd give satisfaction to everyone and expose the pretender. To find the true mother, he could not try which the child loved best. Because, of course, we're dealing with a baby here. But yeah, if you had an older child, yeah, it would work. I told you before the illustration, you know, I used to have a beard. For until I was 50 years old, I had a beard. And when I was at the office, these toddlers would come in and they'd look at me and cry their eyes out. I mean, they just start bawling and screaming and everything else. You know, here's this gray-looking guy, bald with a beard, you know. Well, then one day, this child came in, a toddler, big smile on its face, and pawed my beard and was doing a stroke in the beard and just smiling and laughing and all this. I said, what's going on? And then I went out to the waiting room and I saw the exact carbon copy of me and the dad. So the toddler knew exactly, you know, this was okay. This guy was okay. See? But Solomon here must try which mother loved the child the best. That's what he's after. Which child loved the mother the best? And the way of wisdom sometimes is uncanny. Here's a true story on Charles Spurgeon. I could not believe this, but, you know, God works in mysterious ways. Charles Spurgeon was preaching at Exeter Hall. And Exeter Hall was a place you could be preached to 10,000, 20,000 people. You know, Exeter Hall was huge. And he suddenly departed from his sermon subject. He pointed in a certain direction. He said, "Young man, those gloves you are wearing have not been paid for. You've stolen them from your employer." Boy, that would be quite an interjection in a sermon, wouldn't it? Huh? After the service, the young man, pale and agitated, came to the vestry, begged an interview with Spurgeon, admitted he placed a pair of gloves on the table, and through tears confessed, "It's the first time I've ever robbed my master, and I'll never do it again. You won't expose me, sir, will you? It'd kill my mother if she'd heard I'd become a thief." Yep, God is always there. He's exposing everything. He sees it all, knows it all, and sometimes he uses people like Spurgeon or Solomon to divulge the things that other people don't know about. So the true mother here, love would be revealed. Look at verse 26. "Then the woman whose son was living spoke to the king, for she yearned with compassion." I underline compassion for her son. She said, just hear her cry now. "Oh, my Lord," do you think she got down on her knees and was in a begging Solomon? "Give her the living child, by no means kill him." And then the attitude of the other, "Let him be neither mine nor yours, but divide him." See, you can imagine, you see there's no compassion there at all. Compassion here, filled with compassion in the Hebrew, means this. Her bowels, this is in Hebrew. In Hebrew, her bowels grew hot. So instead of saying filled with compassion, they would say her bowels grew hot. And in fact, the bowels referred to the liver. The Greeks, it was the spleen. So the Hebrew, it was her liver grew hot. In the Greek, it was the spleen grew hot. And that was regarded as the seat of emotions. The seat of emotions back then. Think of the feeling expressed by the true mother when she says, "Oh, my Lord, give her the living child." I've often thought of, just think, you know, let's say you've got a very poor mother and she's going to put her child up for adoption. She loves the child, wants to take care of the child, but knows that she doesn't have any means to take care of that child, and she puts that child up for adoption because she wants what's best for her child. That would be a very tough situation to be in. But this mother is willing then to give up her child then so that the child would live. But the end of verse 26, this non-true mother stood by what she thought was a point of honor. Let the child be divided. And she has no clue, you see, that she's revealing herself not to be the true mother. But what she's revealing is a hateful envy. If I can't have the son, nobody can have the son. See? Matthew Henry said this on verse 27. "So the king answered and said, 'Give the first woman the living child, by no means kill him. She is his mother.'" Let parents, this is Matthew Henry, "let parents show their love to their children by taking care of them, especially by taking care of their souls." How many times have you heard we say, as a parent, your goal is 3 John verse 4, "I have no greater joy than my children walk in truth." I remember when our oldest son kept having children, you know, and he ended up with 6. And here he is in seminary, and then he's getting his doctorate and all that. And Nancy and I kept telling him, just remember, through it all, you keep adding children. Your number one ministry is where? It's at home. That's your number one ministry with these children. And I praise God, now all 6 of them are walking with the Lord, and so we pray the same for the great-grandchildren. Let parents show their love to their children by taking care of them, especially by taking care of their souls, and with a holy violence, snatching them as brands out of the burning. Those who are most likely to have comfort of children, that they do their duty to them. Satan pretends to the heart of man, but by this it appears that he's only a pretender, that he would be content to divide with God, whereas the rightful sovereign of the heart will have all or none. And that's something we've got to underscore, not only for ourselves, but for children, that too, is that God doesn't want just some of us. He wants all, everything, unreservedly. Psalm 119:2, our soldier's sword here lately, is, you know, blessed are those who keep his statutes, who serve him with what? The whole heart, unreservedly. That's what God wants. Think of that hymn, "When I Survey the Wondrous Cross, on which the Prince of Glory died, my richest gain I count but loss, poor contempt and all my pride." And what does the fourth verse say? "Were the whole realm of nature mine, that were a present far too small. Love so amazing, so divine, demands my soul, my life, my what? My all, my all." Now, verse 28. "And all of Israel heard of the judgment which the king had rendered. They feared the king, for they saw that the wisdom of God was in him to administer justice." So just what Solomon wanted in verse 9 and verse 11, God gave to him in verse 12. And this case proves, then, that Solomon had got the gift of wisdom from God. And just think what a great influence this had upon the ease of his government. All the surrounding, not only his own people, but everybody else, would fear the king because of this wisdom. He can solve the unsolvable dilemma. See, seemingly unsolvable dilemma. They were afraid then of doing an unjust thing, for they knew if it ever came before Solomon, he would certainly discover it. They saw the wisdom of God was in him. Wisdom, it says in Ecclesiastes 9:18, is better than weapons of war. It aided Solomon's peaceful reign as king of Israel from 970 to 930 AD. So now, point three. The discerning deity, and we know this points to Jesus Christ. Isaiah 11. It's interesting. Verses 2, 3, and 4. Listen to this. "The Spirit of Yahweh will rest upon him," referring to the Messiah, "the Spirit of wisdom and discernment, and he will not judge by what appears to the eyes." John 7:24, we're not to judge by appearance. We're to judge with a righteous judgment. See, don't judge by appearance. "He will not judge by what appears to the eyes, nor will he decide cases by what he hears with his ears. But he shall judge the weak in righteousness, and he shall decide in uprightness for the downtrodden of the earth." And just think of that, is that Solomon, in his psalm, Psalm 72, "Give the king your judgments, O God, and your righteousness to the king's son," capital S. "He will judge your people with righteousness, your poor with justice. The mountains will bring peace to the people, the little hills by righteousness. He will bring justice to the poor of the people. He will save the children of the needy and will break in pieces the oppressor." Truly, as it says, Matthew 12:42, a greater than Solomon was Jesus. A greater than Solomon. Again, in him are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Have you prayed for wisdom? And where do you go? To whom do you go? You come to him, and he's willing to give liberally. So ask.